Please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Okay, we'll call the meeting to order. Trustee Harris.
Here.
Trustee Genrich.
Here.
Trustee Raptor.
Here.
Trustee Van Noven is here. Trustee Dart.
Here.
Trustee Gass.
Here.
Trustee Dennis.
Here.
Are there any recommended modifications to the agenda this evening? Are there any visitors who'd like to see an item moved up or down on the agenda? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the agenda as submitted? Trustee Harris, second. Trustee Genrich, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Announcements?
We have one, that the Village of Alloway will be accepting unused and unwanted prescriptions and over-the-counter medications for proper disposal. On Sunday, September 27th, here at the Alloway Village Hall, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Are there any other announcements? Yes, Mr. Burke?
Just a quick update on Huffman Road. The county's plan is that by Friday or Saturday to be able to open the road, the roundabout and west to Webster Avenue. The road will be striped and the signage will be put up this week. The paving is just about complete. It should have been finished by end of today. So that portion of the road will open. Unless we get some bad weather for a couple of days and it delays, then it'll be early next week. But it should be by Friday or Saturday morning. And the other thing on Huffman Road, in case you get a phone call or two, there was a glitch in the county's signing or closing the east portion from East River to Huffman, or to the bridge. And they completely closed it off and some people couldn't get home. That's corrected. It was a mistake that they made in setting up barricades. We should be okay, but it did hinder some people getting back and forth.
And did you hear also that someone was given or threatened with a ticket because they were trying to get home and there was no way to get there?
Yeah, but the county has issued a lot of tickets on that road for people that are traveling on the road that shouldn't be there. But, yeah, in this case, if it's a resident, that shouldn't have been an issue. Because the road is to be open to homes first thing in the morning and at the end of the day, so you can get home. But anyway, there was a glitch, just so you know that. But I think the solutions are in the works. At least that's what I heard at 5 o'clock today. So.
Yeah, I had the problem yesterday after work, not being able to get home. And had to turn around, which is all fine. But they're inevitably going to have to close off that section and not let anyone through for certain periods of time.
Certain periods, yes.
Do they then change the barricades in Bellevue and or Bellevue Street and Huffman so that you literally can't get in at all on Huffman all the way to the river in Bellevue? Is that right?
They're doing the finished grading right now. Like tomorrow, it'll probably be complete and they'll start pouring concrete. So the road should be open all the time after that.
Okay.
Won't be able to drive in your driveway because they'll be pouring concrete, but you'll be able to get up and down the road. So it should relax here in the next day or two.
Okay. Thank you. Any other announcements? Hearing none, we will move on to a presentation by the Department of Transportation and Beeden Hunt with regard to Riverside Drive.
All right. First of all, I'd like to thank the board for inviting us out to present an update on the Highway 57 Riverside Drive project. I'll introduce myself. My name is Andy Falser, the Brown County Project Manager with DOT. With me tonight, I also have Dan Segerstrom, DOT, Brown County Project Supervisor. We have Mark Cantala with DOT, one of our communications managers, and also as part of our consultant design team, we have Chris Rossmiller and John Rathke from Meade & Hunt. So tonight I'm going to be presenting on the project, give you a status update of where we are at. We do have a public meeting scheduled for October 8th, so we're going to present to you where we're at with our alternatives right now, and then we appreciate any comments or questions you guys have before we carry that forward to the public meeting in a couple weeks. So. Here's the agenda for our presentation tonight. We're going to give a brief project overview, discuss the purpose and need for our project, go over where we currently are at in the schedule. We have completed a speed study on Riverside Drive. We had a lot of comments about concerns with speed out there, so we'll discuss the results of the speed study and also give some background on speed limits. Some discussion on complete streets and laws requiring us to include bike and pedestrian accommodations with the project. And then we'll have a discussion on our roadway alternatives, where we're at now and how we got to that point. So just a quick display of the project limits. Project starts down in De Pere at near Randall Avenue and then goes through the village of Alloway to the northern village limits near Marine Street. Project purpose. Number one comment we've probably received is the condition of the pavement. Obviously, it's in pretty rough shape, so our number one goal with the project is to improve the condition of the existing pavement. Another goal we have with the project is to provide a safe and efficient transportation corridor for all types of roadway users. So a little bit on the project history. Back in the late 80s, Highway 57 was widened from a two-lane highway to the current four-lane configuration you see out there today. This project, the design started in late summer of 2012, held our first public meeting in February 2013. We met with the stakeholder committee over the last few months, working through some of our design alternatives, and we're ready to bring that forward to another public meeting. So again, fall 2012, when our data gathering phase began, held our first public meeting in 2013, and now we are ready to present alternatives to the board and then also to the public. Going forward from there, we will look at, from any comments from the local officials and then from the public, we'll look at incorporating that into our alternatives and then selecting a preferred alternative, then taking that to another public meeting sometime spring or summer of 2015. Construction is currently scheduled for 2018, so and we're showing right there possibility 2018-2019. So, another item we have received a lot of comments about is the concerns with the speed on Riverside Drive. So this past spring we completed a speed study out on the roadway, and I'm going to share those results with you and also discuss some background on the speed limits. So, why speed limits? We set the value for the speed limit based on how a driver, the comfort level of a driver traveling down the roadway. There's a lot of different constraints that can impact the comfort level, whether it be if it's a wide open roadway, not a lot of buildings, landscaping, trees along the side of the highway, a driver may feel more comfortable driving at a faster rate of speed, whereas if you have medians, raised medians, a lot more driveways, development along the sides of the road, that'll make a driver feel inclined to drive at a little slower speed. So some common misconceptions about speed limits. Lowering the posted speed limit will slow traffic down. Through numerous speed studies in the past, we've found this can actually have the opposite effect. Artificially reducing speed limits can actually reduce driver compliance and therefore will have a negative impact on safety. When you lower the speed limit, you will have some drivers that will obey the posted limit no matter what it says. You'll still have those drivers driving at the speed at which they feel comfortable driving. Therefore, you're creating a wider range of speeds for the travel for vehicles, and therefore you're creating a less safe environment for those trying to turn off or onto the roadway, pedestrians trying to cross the roadway. It makes it harder for them to judge the approaching vehicles because there's not a consistent speed of traffic. So how is the speed limit determined? Again, any speed limit change on a state highway must be done through a speed study. And the national practice is to use the 85th percentile from that resulting from that speed study. The 85th percentile speed is the speed at which most drivers are traveling at that speed or less. So therefore it makes sense to set the speed limit at this speed. So what were the results of the speed study on Riverside Drive? We collected speed data at two different locations. One location north of 172 near Crest Court. The average speed there was found to be 33.5 miles an hour. The 85th percentile speed was at 41.1. We also collected data south of 172 near Arrowhead Drive. The average speed was found to be 34.5 miles an hour, with the 85th percentile at 42.1. So based on the speed study, lowering the speed limit out here would not benefit safety and compliance. Therefore, going forward, we're going to have Highway 57 remain at 35 miles an hour. So another topic that we've had much discussion through our outreach so far has been bike and pedestrian accommodations. So why are we including bike and pedestrian accommodations with this project? Well, first of all, because it's a state law and a federal policy that requires accommodating bike and pedestrian facilities on highway projects. So there was also, you'll also hear me reference Train 75. That was an administrative code developed to create guidance on how to implement the law. So why bike and pedestrian accommodations? Well, first of all, as I said, it's the law. Second of all, we feel it's the right thing to do. Implementing bike and pedestrian accommodations can benefit the community by providing additional access to residents and businesses. And as a transportation agency, DOT also has a responsibility to provide a transportation corridor that provides opportunities for all roadway users. So, what qualifies as a complete street, or what meets the requirements of the law? So, roadways designed and operated to be safe and accessible for all users regardless of age or ability. So, for all different types of pedestrians, all ages, whether they be able or blind, buses, bicyclists, drivers, not only passenger cars, but also trucks. So what is the law? WISDOT is required to ensure that accommodation for all facilities funded with both state or federal money includes bike and pedestrian accommodations. This is consistent with federal policy. And then, as I said before, the state does provide further guidance through Train 75, at the administrative code. And that Train 75 also further explains exceptions, if there's any exceptions to the state law. So how is the rule applied? Obviously, we have different levels of projects. For instance, like a resurface level project where we're just milling off a couple inches of asphalt, putting a new surface on. For those types of projects, we must adhere to federal policy, but only to the maximum extent possible. So maybe we can only widen the shoulder a foot or two. On other types of projects, such as pavement replacements, reconstruction level projects, new construction, we must incorporate Train 75 unless there are specific exceptions to the rule. So what qualifies as bikeways and pedestrian ways? A bikeway can be anything from a bike lane separated from the roadway by pavement marking, a raised curb, maybe a wider paved shoulder, a wider outside lane. Maybe it's not marked like an actual bike lane, but a wide outside lane, 14 feet or wider, and also paths which are separated from the roadway. Sidewalks, definition of a sidewalk, it's a portion between the curb and the adjacent property line. Typically, it's a 5-foot concrete walk separated from the curb and gutter by a 5-foot terrace. So a little bit more information on paths. With PATH, we have to differentiate between a recreational facility and a transportation facility. For instance, we have the Fox River Trail, which just runs parallel to Riverside Drive along the river. By definition, that is a recreational facility, and therefore it is not considered a viable transportation alternative, and therefore doesn't qualify as an accommodation under the Trans 75 guidance. The law specifies that on-street facilities must be included when possible. PATHs are more used in applications where we have controlled access along a highway. Speed limits are 45 miles per hour or higher. So this, an example, this would be like Highway 172, 29, 41. So what are exceptions per Trans 75? What are some exceptions to the state law? Again, facilities where bike and ped access is prohibited, so freeways. If including bike and pedestrian accommodations, if the total cost for including those facilities totals up to 20% or more of the project, we can look at dialing those back to a maximum of 20% of the project. There's also an instance where if adding accommodations will result in negative impacts because of a constrained environment, if there's an absence of need, and if the community refuses to accept agreement to maintain the facilities. Now, as far as the maintenance goes, because Highway 57 is on the national highway system, that one, the last exception does not apply. So a little bit more information on a constrained environment. The exception here is meant if there are environmental or structural constraints that do not allow the inclusion of the facilities for at least 50% of the project length. And then just a little bit more background on the Trans 75 rule. If a project has state or federal funding, Trans 75 must be followed. So now on to a status update on where we're at with design. So as I said, back in the fall of 2012, we began data collection on the project. Specifically, we set up two counts to collect traffic data. We also set up a video data collection system. We set up cameras on numerous intersections along both Riverside and Webster between the roundabout and De Pere all the way up to Mason Street, collecting real-world data that could be implemented into our traffic model. So how we use this data? We incorporated the video data into a software called Paramix, a traffic modeling software. And this allowed us to create a real-world simulation of both Riverside Drive and Webster Avenue. From there, within the traffic model, we could change lane configurations, change the number of lanes, add intersection controls, and then we can evaluate how traffic is reacting to these changes. Is it diverting between the roadways? Is it using one of the local roads more than the other? Are we creating, maybe we're solving an issue at one intersection and then we're creating an issue at another along a separate roadway. So one thing to note here with the traffic model, we do have videos displaying how the traffic changes and how it reacts to some of our alternatives. And what we're planning to do is, at the public meeting, we will have flat screen TVs set up along the sides of the gym. So if anybody's interested in seeing those videos, they will be there on the side. We're not planning to present them. Some of them can be kind of lengthy and it's tough to grasp right away. So if you guys do have any questions on that, we'd be glad to share that with you. But we aren't including it as part of the presentation right now. So our alternatives development. We looked at a few different alternatives for Riverside Drive. First one being a three-lane roadway, which would be two lanes, one lane in each direction, with a center two-way left turn lane. When we put this into the model, we found that Riverside Drive was cleaned up pretty well. We were finding that a lot of traffic was diverting to Webster. So we were seeing a lot of issues pop up along the local systems, side roads and intersections along Webster Avenue. So going forward, based on the results of the traffic model, we are not proposing to carry this alternative forward to the public meeting. So What we are continuing to look at is a four-lane undivided section, which is very similar to what's out there today. We're also looking at a four-lane section with a combination of a centered turn lane and raised median. So we're incorporating turn lanes at some of the intersections and then also medians in some of the areas where there's less driveways and side roads. So we'll get into that in a little bit, show you guys what that looks like. So as we said before, we are incorporating accommodations for non-motorized users. We are currently showing sidewalk on both sides of the roadway throughout the corridor, as well as the wider outside lane to accommodate bikes. And as we continue to develop our alternatives and then move forward with our preferred alternative, we'll continue to evaluate safety. We'll look at things such as sight distance, vision corners at intersections, where it makes sense to implement some pedestrian crossings as well. So those are things we'll continue to evaluate as we move forward. So after this meeting, take any comments you have. We'll be taking our alternatives to a public involvement meeting on October 8th. That will be at Aldo Leopold Community School at 5 p.m. Invites will be sent out later next week. Our plan going forward from there is to take in comments we get from the local officials, from the public, use that to refine our designs, and from there select a preferred alternative. After that, we'll take it back, the design back to the stakeholder committee, and then to another public involvement meeting to present our preferred alternative before we wrap up our preliminary design phase and complete our environmental document. So at this time, we're going to have Chris run through our alternatives here and show you what we got going so far, and then we'll take any questions that you guys have.
Andy had mentioned, we're primarily looking at two alternatives, a four-lane undivided section similar to what is there today, as well as various sections of undivided roadway, not necessarily through the entire corridor. What I'm going to start with right now is the undivided roadway. As you look at these, it's important to note that a preferred alternative has not been set, and what one of the goals we're looking for from the public meeting is what areas, what do they like, what sections do they like at different components of the roadway. The preferred alternative could be a hybrid, a combination of these two different layouts, not necessarily one or the other as you look through them. So just zooming in here, starting just north of Randall Street, approximately where the concrete pavement ends, four-lane undivided sidewalk on both sides of the roadway. Proceeding past the Abbey, various colors here representing the yellow being sidewalk, purple area, areas identified as historic or archaeological concerns around the corridor through our historical and archaeological surveys, blue areas, wetlands, green areas are also environmentally sensitive sites, hazardous materials, other things in past that we need to evaluate as we go through our process. So some of the components that we are looking at is with sidewalks, trying to identify areas and of pedestrian crossings that see a lot of traffic today. Area around the Fox Point boat launch being one of those areas, looking at providing a refuge in some of those areas to allow for two-stage crossing rather than the person waiting trying to get a gap across the road all in one move. They'd be able to cross one stream of traffic at a time. Continuing up the roadway, undivided through the area around Sunset Circle neighborhood, St. Francis, another pedestrian refuge in the area of Arrowhead Drive. The red box here Some of the safety concerns that we look at is alignments of intersections as they go through. This intersection in particular, as you zoom in, has misalignment. We are looking at various alternatives as part of the design process. Also reaching out to property owners in this area to get their comments on this intersection. Some of the alternatives that we've been looking at include some looking at a possible realignment of that intersection for traffic lanes be directly lined up with each other. Also looking for comment on potentially closing that intersection. This roadway currently serves 7 homes that also have access via Arrowhead Drive. As we get closer to the interchange, we started looking at areas of high traffic. We received a lot of comments during the stakeholder process of the Willowbrook complex when it was fully developed, being a large traffic generator, looking at providing left turn access to and also to Taft Street. Up at the interchange, this area would widen to a divided roadway similar to as it is today to allow the left turns to and from the interchange ramps. Again, as we get closer to Lazar, we'd be reducing down to a 4-lane undivided roadway. That carries us up to set 172. Right now I'm going to back up. This would be an area where we've also provided a median alternative through this entire stretch. So I'll give you an opportunity to look at that option. Starting again at the south near Randall Avenue, we have an option here to introduce a 14-foot center turn lane in the area of the businesses. This would allow traffic moving in either direction, the opportunity to pull into the center median as a refuge rather than sitting in a through lane. It's a safety component, lowering the risk of rear-end collisions. Also with that center turn lane, it does allow us those options for raised medians, such as we had talked about the refuge before. It allows turn lanes. Right now we're showing turn lanes as we enter into Sunset Circle neighborhood to the various roadways. With this option, I had presented the alignment issue on the other alternative. The median option would allow us an opportunity to use the median as actually not permitting a left turn, where the left turns could potentially be a conflict. Pedestrian refuge in this case, due to the short distance, though, would need to be moved north of Arrowhead Drive as an option. With the median as well, similar to South, I had mentioned businesses. Again, we can look at providing refuges, allowing vehicles to turn in and out of those businesses. The left turns at Taft. The interchange configuration at this point is similar to the undivided section. Following the PIM, as part of the process, we will continue to evaluate intersections. At this point, we will be evaluating roundabouts wherever there are signals warranted. Currently, with the two signalized intersections, we will be evaluating roundabouts at the two ramp terminals. Alloway Avenue and St. Joseph's Street also met signal warrants, so we will be evaluating both signals and roundabouts at those locations as well. North of 172, 4-lane divided option similar today. The bike accommodations up in this area are currently shown at 4 feet. sidewalks and terraces for all these alternatives have been shown at 6-foot terrace from the curb to the sidewalk and a 5-foot sidewalk. Terraces, critical component of the roadway. It's areas where we're going to put, where utilities can put their facilities, lighting, landscaping, if wish to add trees as a component on the highway, along the highway. So it is something, right now we're showing a desirable distance along all alternatives of 6 feet. It's 4-lane undivided. As we approach Alloway Avenue, we do show raised medians for placement of signal equipment in these alternatives. Again, roundabouts will be evaluated as the process continues. Similar to St. Joseph's Court, providing pedestrian crossings in these areas, the area of the intersection as well. As part of our last stakeholder meeting, we received some comments on the north end as well to look at potentially utilizing the 14-foot turn lane as an option in area of businesses. The comments that we received were looking at areas where states would provide allowing that, so those left turns could be made out of the stream of traffic. We received those from a few residents on the committee. As we get north of St. Joseph's Court, due to the constraints that we have going to the north with the retaining walls, the existing railroad structure, we do stop the sidewalk on the west side near the parking lot that's used for trail access at times, with crossing back at St. Joseph's Court, maintain one sidewalk going north through this area. As you see, as we get up closer to railroad crossing, we have the existing retaining walls between the Fox River Trail as well as the Woodlawn Cemetery that create pinch points in the roadway as well as the existing railroad crossing itself. But we are able to maintain the roadway with a sidewalk on one side to connect neighborhoods on both sides of the structure. And as we continue north, Derby Lane, showing an addition of a right turn lane at this location. And again, to the north, we are showing widening the median in here, again, providing left turn access to and from some of the businesses in this area. Ultimately tying into the existing Monroe Street in Green Bay. There's any areas if you want to go over questions of areas.
There's a question about the Lazar Street. There was no pedestrian access there, and it currently I think gets a lot of pedestrian traffic toward the trail. Just north of Harry Camp.
We do not show pedestrian access at Lazar right now. The thought being that working in conjunction with the current project underway to connect Webster to the Fox River Trail, utilizing that crossing with the signal so that they'd have push button activity at that location rather than Lazar would be uncontrolled.
Okay. You go way back to the north, last one. I'm just thinking of access to Marine Street down there.
As far as
well, if things change down there, how would people get down there? Is there any other things we need to start thinking about for?
Typically with access, if you guys have any planned developments down along the river, we heard there was some potential plans
area,
there.
Yes.
That's something the village would have to coordinate with us if you have plans, some type of traffic impact analysis developed on the development, that's something we could look at incorporating into our project as far as if turn lanes needed, but we need that data from you guys. Mm-hmm.
And at what point in time do you need that data?
As soon as you can get it to us.
Okay.
The sooner the better. I mean, we can always, I mean, depending on what it is, as far as we understand Marine Street, we know it dives down pretty quick down there. So any changes to to Marine Street itself would be part of the village's responsibility. But as far as how that accesses Riverside Drive, any information you can provide us, like if we would need to incorporate some type of additional turn lane there, that's what we need the traffic impact analysis from. We can't just throw a turn lane on.
Sure. I guess I'm looking at timing. We're looking at different alternatives and having some work done down there, or at least thinking of the future. And I'm thinking, how are we going to get that done?
So I mean, we're always willing to work with you. So, I mean, we would prefer to have it sooner
than
later.
When do you plan on having this finalized?
Well, the construction will begin in 18, so our final plans will be due in November of 2017. We have our review process, so we'd want it well before that. If there's any real estate involved, we'd like to begin acquiring the real estate at least a year out from our final plan date. So that puts us in middle of 2016. So, I mean, then in order
we have some time then.
You do have some time, correct. Yes.
But the preferred alternative, if I remember correctly, was slated for winter spring of this coming
year. Yes, the preferred alternative, I mean, we can always make changes, you know, access type changes to that preferred alternative. The preferred alternative we are trying to come up with is basically what type of configuration are we going to run through the corridor? Are we going to run the four-lane undivided section? Are we going to look at a hybrid, including some medians and some turn lanes in there? Do we want to look at a full median all the way through both the southern and northern section? That's kind of what we have on the table right now. We don't have a full divider or a median through the north side.
We do not have a full median through the north.
Okay. So
there's just not enough room.
So as far as when we get to that preferred alternative, from there, then we have a lot of work to do to focus more on the intersections, access, division corners. That's where we look at working something in there like that.
So one of the items on the agenda is a planning study for Webster and Riverside Drive. And I think one of the things we're probably going to be wondering is, can we collect enough data if we decide to go out with this RFP and get someone started on some of that planning that could provide data to you? How long would we have to do that? From what I hear you saying is that we have to decide on sort of the one major issue, and that's whether we have a four lane with a divider, or whether it's a hybrid, or no divider at all. That needs to be decided winter, spring of 2015, coming up here in the next 6 months. Okay.
Yep.
But then all the details about intersections and how things are configured, that...
Yeah, those are more things that are more, you know, that's site specific. You know, we'll work through that as we approach final design, and then obviously we like to have a lot of the more of those larger items ironed out before we get into final design. But we can continue to analyze those impacts as we go through our process.
And then land acquisition, you mentioned, which I would imagine there's one model, especially if you have four lanes and a median, lots of medians and turn lanes, that's going to require a wider road and more land acquisition. Is that correct?
Correct. That would.
What sorts of numbers are we talking about between the alternatives? Between the, narrowest road and the widest road?
I can speak from section lists. Existing right now, back of curb is 49 feet. The undivided alternative, it goes up to 59 feet. So you're adding 5 feet of width of the roadway on each side. With the 14-foot center turn lane added to that, you're now up to 72 feet. Back of curb. As Andy was mentioning before, as far as the details, the individual impacts. We've been showing consistently the terraces and the sidewalks 6 foot and 5 foot throughout. As we, once we have that roadway section, that preferred roadway section, we can start evaluating those impacts. Do we need to narrow up terraces and work through those alternatives with those options?
Well, for now, we really need to focus. In my mind, we need to focus on if we go with the alternative that's 70 feet. What we're talking about is, did I hear you say it's 49 now?
It's 49 now.
So we go up to 70 is 21 feet. We're talking about 10 and a half feet on each side.
That plus 22 feet for the sidewalks.
Plus 22 for the sidewalks?
Yes.
Yeah, 11 on each side.
Oh, 11 on each side. Okay.
So you're going to 90, from 49 to 94.
And it's quite a bit of property, right?
Yeah, that's with the median alternative. We would be acquiring more property than we'd have to acquire more property. So.
And even with the undivided, you would.
With the undivided, we'll likely have some right-of-way impacts throughout the corridor as well.
So. And the twiddle alternative went away because of the perceived or planned effect. Because it would divert traffic to Webster, basically.
Correct.
So it would not carry the volume that you had hoped as an alternative.
With converting the four-lane section to a three-lane section would be considered a road diet. A road diet, typically, the upper limits of when a road diet can be implemented is that 19,000 to 20,000 vehicles per day. And we project out traffic on Riverside, we're right at that upper limit. So those numbers, it would be possible, so that's why we evaluated it further with the traffic model. Now, when we took a look at the traffic model, traffic out here on Riverside Drive, it's a lot of through traffic, a lot of commuter traffic, so that may have an impact on how the model was reacting. So when we narrowed it down to two through lanes on Riverside, we saw a lot of diversion over to Webster. There was a couple intersections that were queuing up. Was there some on the 172 ramps as well?
The 172 ramps, on the south portion, we saw quite a bit of diversion onto George Street, Chicago Street, even south of the roundabout. We started seeing vehicles diverting over, working their way to Webster Avenue. Hoffman Road was an area of concern. The George Street intersection, the two ramp terminals, we're backing up further. On the north end, we saw traffic diverting away from Alloway Avenue and St. Joseph's using Derby Lane and roadways to the north to as a cut-through between Riverside and Webster Avenue.
So we did analyze the three-lane section. I mean, that, you know, that would benefit from less right-of-way impacts when you're narrowing the section by a lane, more or less. But as far as from a traffic, from an operations standpoint, it just didn't work for the Webster Riverside Drive corridors as a whole. So. Okay.
Andy, one of the things that we talked about the last stakeholder meeting, and I think both tables came up with this, was the residential section on the west side of Riverside, north of 172, up to what, Alloway Avenue, I'm guessing. That there would be potentially an opportunity not to have a sidewalk there because of the impact to the property, those short yards that there are there now. What is the opportunity for that?
There is some opportunities to look at reducing the sidewalk to only one side of the roadway. Being that we presented the alternatives with sidewalk on both sides at the stakeholder committees, we wanted to present that to the board. We'll also present that to the city to peer their local officials, and we are going to present that at the public meeting. What our thought is here is we want to gather comments, again, from the board and from the public, and we can take that back. Obviously, we had the comments from the stakeholder committee already, and before we look at areas where we can possibly go down to a sidewalk on one side, we want to gather comments from all the...
So this is the same presentation that you gave to the stakeholders?
Yes. Okay. So there is opportunity for looking at that, yes. Okay.
And the red areas, primarily at the intersections, but is that where you acquire land, or is that just where property owners cannot put any structures?
This would be primarily, Andy had mentioned the presentation, vision corners and site triangles from intersections. Yeah. One of the comments at the first PIM was some of the visibility to turn out on the roadway, being able to see cars that were in that outside lane approaching an intersection. These smaller triangles are not a good example. This one in particular is not a good example. I can explain why in a second. Normally, you'd see the triangles, the smaller triangles are sight lines. This one looks a little bigger because you're seeing two overlapping. You're seeing a sight triangle coming from Derby Lane as well as a sight triangle from Quincy Court.
So that's, what does that do to those property owners who have a parking lot there? North of Quincy, for example? In that shaded area?
Did they purchase the
corner? Yeah. In that case right there, we'd evaluate if there's something we can do to the intersection to try and lessen the impacts and get the site triangle closer to the roadway. We're going to look for some kind of engineering solution to that before we want to go and get a PLE to eliminate parking in those areas. So that's part of the final design that we'll be working through after we get through selecting our preferred alternatives. We'll look at how we can lessen those impacts. That's a big part of our final design, is we can give the big picture. Here's what the ideal scenario is. Let's get chosen alternative. And then from there, we work back, okay, where can we lessen the impacts to the property and still meet our efficient roadway users for cars, pedestrians, and bikes. But in that situation, yeah, it's possible. If there's a possibility that we would have to eliminate some parking in some areas, we're going to try and engineer around it wherever we can. And it's also possible that we can go for an exception on some of those intersections at the real low volume. We
and have then to apply for that. Some of the site triangles at some of the residential streets, Rose Lawn as an example, Briar Lane, where they've already had land. I walked that whole corridor. This would be cutting into people's driveways, and I mean that's a lot.
Yeah, and what we do is sometimes we'll get a PLE, an easement type thing, where they can't have anything over a certain height. So, you know, like impacting a driveway or a sidewalk, or mostly what it would impact in that case is like landscaping, if they have bushes or fences that come out to it. But it would be, we can purchase it so that it's actually, we're just buying the right to minimize the height of objects in there, but they actually own the property.
What's a PLE? A purchase land easement?
It's a permanent land easement rather than a temporary. A TLE is a temporary land easement. A permanent land easement would be where we permanently have an easement there to control something such as the height of the vegetation or objects within that area, but they still own the land. They can still have a driveway there. They can still have a lawn.
Do any exist right now along that stretch?
I'm not aware of any looking at the existing plan.
And just
we do have site triangle problems along Riverside.
We do, no doubt.
Very serious.
And on the north or on the west side of Riverside, down in that area, because there's a lot more land, is there a way that might be in the final design details? But can you push out into the west instead of impacting the property owners on the east side? Say down by Dairy Queen, Rose Lawn, Briar Lane.
So as you widen the road, just widen on one side and
widen it to the west.
Yes. Actually, yes.
Okay.
So that's the details of, you know, after we choose, or you choose, or together we choose a preferred alternative. The details are, all right, so we're going to have to widen the road 10 feet. It's a detail as to whether it's all on one side, and the road actually shifts, or whether it's split 5 to 5. Is that
correct? That's what. Ultimately, going forward, based on the preferred alternative, we'll take comments from you guys, from the public, and incorporate that all in together, and DOT will ultimately make the final decision on the preferred alternative.
Right.
But yes, as far as where those impacts are, that's something we will continue to analyze through final design as far as overall, can the roadway shift? Can we pull sidewalk in, more of a commercial sidewalk on one side, things like that. So yeah, that's as we keep moving forward, those are things we look at, is how can we lessen the impacts as much as we can. So,
and you know, I know the DOT makes the final decision on the alternative. How does that process go? We're going to have something on October 8th, and you're going to get more comments, and then sometime in the winter or spring, the DOT makes the decision.
What we're planning to do is we'll take it to the next public meeting. From there, we'll refine, come up with a preferred alternative, refine it based on the comments. That's where we look at the sidewalk question we had before. Try to lessen some of the impacts if we get any comments, hotspot areas. Come up with that preferred alternative. We're going to plan on taking it back to the stakeholder committee, get their thoughts on it, and then ultimately take it back to the local officials again and present it to the public from there. So.
When
is the decision made, though? When you bring it back to the board after you talk to the stakeholders, and is the decision made and you're just informing us what it is, or when is the actual, this is the alternative that we're going with, and we're going to work out the details in this alternative?
Yeah, the preferred alternative would be selected sometime between the next public information meeting, and then we'd come up with the preferred alternative. So sometime this fall or winter, we'd work on that, and then we'd bring it back to the stakeholder committee, get comments from them, bring it back to the local officials, and then to the public. Yeah, it would be more, we'd be presenting you with the preferred alternative at that time.
So before you go back to the stakeholder committees, the preferred alternative has been set, and you're informing. You're not
correct.
Asking for any more input. So the final input on the preferred alternative.
I just want to make sure we clarify that. No, we will go back to the stakeholder committees like where we were. We have significant. We got to make sure that this is clarified. When it comes to the sidewalk, the preferred is always to have sidewalk on both sides of the road. But if we can show that there are significant constraints, significant impacts to have it on both sides of the roadway, it does give us the option of reducing it down one side of the roadway. So that's something we're going to look at. That's something we'll take back to the stakeholders, get input, you know, after the public meeting as to where we can do that type of information or do that kind of reduction. And then when we select a preferred alternative and bring it back to the stakeholders, that something like going through the sidewalks and all that is going to be part of the preferred alternative in the end, where we eliminate them. So the stakeholders are going to have input into that preferred alternative. Then when we actually figure out exactly what our lane configuration is going to be, where our sidewalks are going to be, we will present that to the stakeholders, to the public, and to you guys. And that is our preferred alternative. That does not mean it is selected. That means we are showing you what the preferred alternative is and given one last chance for input on it. Then we'll take those comments and finalize our environmental document and move forward with it. Okay. So, you know, basically the preferred alternative you're going to see is probably what's going to move forward unless we get some significant comments from the public, from the stakeholders, or from you guys when we show it to you that changes our perspective on it. You know, kind of changes the balance of why we chose it as to prefer. So it's kind of a two-part answer. It's like, yeah, we're going to show you what we want to move forward with. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that's absolute must until after we get all the comments in.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? I had a question about the invitations. You said 65 invitations?
600.
So 680.
Okay.
It's the current size of our mailing list. It includes all the residents along Riverside Drive, as well as primarily most of the almost all the residents on the west side of the roadway between the river and Riverside, as well as going up into the neighborhoods on the east side.
65 is kind of a select group.
Sample. 680, and then it also includes anyone from the first meeting or any of the stakeholder meetings that are requested to be on the mailing list.
Thank you. Was the issue addressed to the folks that did not receive their invitations or information in previous meetings? I think there was a possibility it was sent to an office somewhere, and there were, instead of something being sent to their home address, people were legitimately, I think there were two people that live like right next to each other who were not notified, and I'm just curious if
we always try our best to get all residents. We start with Brown County tax records, so as properties change hands, if someone was living off-site, the first meeting in particular, we had some comments that people didn't receive invites, and that may have been property changing hands where the main mailing address was elsewhere in the city. This list we have gone through, there has been some, in the last year, has been some real estate changing hands we've gone through in the last week, and updating that to the current tax records. Also, as we get comments, we're updating that.
I think one of them was like a revocable trust or something.
Right.
Yeah. It was mailed to an office and got lost in the dead letter file. So.
As we've been going through the list, updating, checking the properties, if we have a property address listed in a tax record and then a secondary address where it may be a rentee situation, we're actually added both addresses this time to make sure that it's going to the physical address as well as property owner in that case.
We did receive a few very specific instances where they said they wanted a change, and that was sent on to them to incorporate that to the mailing list. But unless we get those very specific, it's going to go to what's on the tax listings. So.
And then, kind of going back a step, you're talking about the process and deciding what things are going to be done. When is the actual end drop-dead date?
For the alternative.
For the alternative.
When you finally say, this is it, cowboy, we're writing this one.
For the preferred alternative or for the final design?
For the final program, for the final design, when you say, this is it, we're not changing anything.
For the preferred alternative, I think a goal date is to have that selected and approval on that, or everybody's on board with it. And then we complete our environmental document. That would be next summer, 2015. As far as when the final design is completed, that would be middle of 2017. So we'll continue to work through a lot of the finer details all the way through 2017. And then obviously the project begins to begin construction in 2018. So we'd like to have a lot of the preferred alternative, the bigger decisions made very early on in the process, because then that allows us to get out in front of plenty of time for any real estate acquisitions we have to complete within the final year and a half of the design process. So it's never really over for us. So if that answers your question.
Jenny, could we get a copy of the presentation, including those maps?
Yes. You want to coordinate that with Craig?
Sure.
Yeah, that would be great. Thanks.
Any further questions or comments?
Anybody ask any questions?
I was just going to do that, sir. But
thank you.
Thank you. Unless there are objections, I'll open it up to the public for any questions or comments. Yes, sir.
A question. How was the need for sidewalks established? What keeps coming to mind is the village installed some sidewalk on far south end of town, I think 3 or maybe 4 years ago. I've seen exactly one person during that time on that sidewalk. Who's going to pay for the sidewalks? I'm thinking about the cost of installation. And of course, the state's going to acquire it. That's going to be a cost. And then, looking, if I saw that correctly.
Mr. Matuzic, could you speak into the microphone up there, please? Thanks.
My questions were that how was the need for sidewalks established, who's going to pay for them, why they're on both sides, which I guess he's addressed that, they're going to look at that, who's going to maintain them, and looking at the cost aspect, you have to acquire the land, you have to install it, and secondly, I saw that photo correctly, I have proposed immediately south of Marine Street. For life, I can't say who's possibly going to use that because it's an unusable piece of land. But it used to be a gas station there many years ago, but nobody's been able to develop it because there's a sidewalk showing. Who'd like to answer?
Do we have any answers to those questions about who's going to?
How do you establish the need, first of all?
Well, how we establish the need? Well, first of all, as we showed in the presentation, it's a state law requiring us to accommodate sidewalks. So we first have to look at accommodating sidewalks on both sides. And that's what we're showing in our preferred alternative, or in our alternatives right now. So as far as going forward, what's that?
You do have alternatives available.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. As far as going forward, as far as looking at sidewalk, maybe only on one side, that's something we're going to evaluate through gathering comments from the board, the public, and stakeholder committee, and then we'll look at evaluating that after the public meeting.
Is the sidewalk cost part of that project cost or village cost?
The sidewalk is 100% state, federal funded, federally funded. So.
Thank you. I'll be back.
The maintenance of the sidewalk does fall back on the village then, and then it's up to the village whether that's designated to the property owners or not. So.
Okay, thank you.
Is there anything else you'd like to make a comment or ask a question? Yes, ma'am.
Hello, I'm Becky Nyberg and I live at 214 Simonette Street, and you all know me. I've lived here since 2002, and since 2004 I've been working with Alloy Walks and Bikes, and I really want to make a comment simply because they kept saying it's the law that you have to have sidewalks and bicycle lanes. But what I really wanted to say is, even if it wasn't the law, it's what makes sense for the village. It's the right thing to do. Because of the way the village is laid out, there are only three routes to go north-south in the village. And no matter how you want to do that, you have to use those three routes. There's just no alternative. And so we have to accommodate everybody, because I'm on my bicycle on Webster, I'm on my bicycle on Riverside Drive, because there's just no place else to go. And we really want to continue to make the village a really friendly place and easier to walk and bicycle. And honestly, the reason that I started Alloway Walks and Bikes was because in 2004, I was driving down Riverside Drive, and there was a man with a jogging stroller standing by the side of the road, trying to cross the road. And he did a sign of the cross and shut his eyes and ran across the road. And it just hit me. I don't want to live in a place where people have to pray before they cross the street. And so I've been working since then. We started out, our first meeting was, how do we get people from the homes that, you know, everybody in this village lives within 2 miles of Fox River Trail. How do we get them there? How do we do it? So it's just really important that it's not that it's the law. I mean, that's a fallback, but it's that it's really important and that it's worth the money and it's worth the time. And I know there's going to have to be adjustments. And I know, and honestly, taking a median out of the middle of the road or putting median in the middle of the road or putting sidewalks in, the sidewalks are more important. So just so that you look at all that. The other thing that concerns me is that the citizens committee that's been looking at this project, there isn't really anybody on that committee who actually rides a bike or who goes out for a walk. And so a lot of people on the committee have been poo-pooing the whole idea. And the people who are the bicycle advocates in the community have all been put on the flower pots and, you know, the other committee, you know, flower pots and planting committee, where afterwards, and you know, you've got me. Everybody be asked to be on the design committee, and we weren't. None of us were put on it, and it's a little concerning to me. But I just wanted to say, you know, I'm really excited. I'm excited because we're doing Riverside Drive. I'm excited that Webster's coming up, and we can really make a difference to connect the community, and I think that's really important.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak? Yes, sir.
Jim O'Rourke, 2339 Oakwood Avenue. I think these guys are doing a great job. They have world-class engineering skills. My only concern is that they're not city planners and that we should be including city planners that we have in-house now and access to, primarily from Brown County and even the guys in De Pere and the city of Green Bay. We should be accessing those guys to give us some ideas on what we would like this corridor to look like. So that's something that we can do right away, and you can get done in 90 days and bring those guys in instead of taking a year or two to do a study and get a study when it's done, when it's too late. The other thing that I am concerned about is Heritage Hill has some magnificent property, and the state also owns some property where we have our retention ponds, and that should be included in this process as an alternative to the sidewalks and the bikeways through the corridor from 172 to St. Joseph Street. So that's what I call the sacred stretch of highway. I've talked to the state about that already. There's a lot of historic properties that were overlooked and should be included in the Section 106 study, and I've talked to the state about that already. But there's some real concerns there. Those people have some rights because they are historic properties, and particularly Heritage Hill is one of our great cultural assets, and that should be recognized in addition to the Abbey property. Thanks.
Is there anyone else who would like to speak or has a question? Hearing none, we'll take up the rules. Any further questions or comments from the board? October 8th, 5 o'clock at Aldo Leopold. Okay. Well, I did have one final question. The speed limit thing, I understand the logic behind it, and it creates different speeds of traffic, and that can be difficult to navigate. Broadway in De Pere is 25, correct? And Monroe Street in Green Bay is 25. Now, I understand one of your original comments was the design of the street and how close there are trees or buildings to the street can help to slow down traffic, but how is it that Green Bay and De Pere can get away with 25-mile-an-hour zones? And I would imagine people don't go 25, but they may go 30, and we're talking having our speed limit be 35 and have people go 40.
Yeah, there's a couple different factors that get into that. Number one might be the amount of turning traffic in, you know, that maybe they get a little bit more turning traffic, and therefore you get the slower speeds when you go out there and do the speed study.
Yeah.
Okay, so it justifies having it. Whereas in this part, you have more of a commuter, you have a lot more through traffic. So that can play a significant part in it. Driveway density plays a part in it. You have sections where you have pretty significant driveway density. You have other sections where there's hardly any driveway on one side of the road.
Right.
So that definitely plays into it also. They are connecting highways can do their own speed studies. Sometimes they can set their speed limit down 5 miles per hour underneath just on their own without having to justify it with a speed study. So that can have an impact on it, too. I think it's a combination of all those factors. So.
Thank you. Trustee Dennis?
I just have a question. Is there information available about the possibility of speed change in direct proportion to the widening of the road itself, going from, say, 49 to 79 or whatever? Possibilities of increased speed?
There's not necessarily specific to it, but there is data that does suggest that going wider does increase the speeds. That is part of a roadway diet. That's one big reason why the two lane with the center turn lane was looked at, because that has been shown to decrease speeds. I just had a seminar on it today, or 1 hour webinar, I should say. And, you know, in, out in Seattle where they did it, you know, average speeds were around 43. They dropped down to 39, 40. So you get, you know, maybe a 10% drop. That is one problem with widening the roadway, is that can increase the speeds. But you can also put in pavement markings where you put in a fog line or something that feels people, makes people feel more constrained and can actually lower the speed down. So, that's one reason why we're looking at the median. The median will make people feel more constrained, even though you're widening it. Then you can help lower the speed limits by having the median in there, having the pedestrian refuges and all that. Those are the type of things that make people feel less comfortable. So that's, we're trying to incorporate those into there to help get the speeds down.
Anything further? Okay, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it. See you on the 8th.
appearances. Is there anyone who'd like to speak this evening? We are going to open it up when we get to item number 7 and 9. So, Mr. Pickard, if you're here to speak on either item 7 or 9, if you want to.
No, I was going to speak on item number 9.
Okay, can you hold off on that? I'm going to open it up when we get to that
okay.
item.
Okay,
thank you.
Yes, sir. I thought you might be back regarding the same issue, but you waited a little while.
Which one?
The issue about the Riverside project. I think you're going to come back and speak again about that one.
But no, not now.
You waited for a whole other issue.
I'll be later. I have three items, but you're going to defer one until later, so I'll address it then. So I've got two items. The first one is, where are we at with the old village hall? You've been having closed meetings off and on for the last couple of years. We see no announcements of what's going on. You've had one recently again. I've heard some comments I don't like to hear from a realtor and a developer, two separate entities, that I asked them what their opinion and what opinion I have which would work on that property, which I can share with you if you want me to. And he says, yeah, but he says, the reason is interest because people don't like, developers don't like dealing with alloy. That's not a good reputation to have.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope it's not true, but that's what I've heard. So if it make a doubly reasonable, there are times in the past where we made difficulty with good reason, and you may have some too. But I don't think we ever had a reputation that we could were impossible to deal with, and you don't want that to happen, so I'm just calling it to your attention.
Thank you.
Where are we at with that property? It's been sitting there for 8 years. I estimate we've lost at minimum on $500,000 in tax revenue during that period of time.
Yeah, I want to sell that property as much as anyone in the village. And as you might have guessed from the closed session meetings we've been having, we've had some interest from a number of different developers and have gone into discussions that would warrant a closed session.
More than one right now going on, or just one?
There's always a list of at least a handful that we've had that have shown some interest. And recently we've had some very active interest in the property with different developers.
Get rid of it.
You want to buy it? You want to buy it?
No. If I had enough money, I got an idea where I could use it for, though, and I think it would work. But not quite in this real estate market where this would work. I'm sure he'd agree. Anyhow, the next thing is more getting impression. It seems that you decided to develop a liking for hiring consultants. And it has to do with the proposed 57 corridor study, which I think might be premature and maybe not necessary or could be reduced in scope. The reason I say that, you have yourselves, you're all educated, intelligent people, you've got professional staff, you've got a planning commission, you've got an economic development committee, you've got a recently adopted comprehensive plan, you've got a lot of tools there, and a question, the need for a full-scale study. Personally, and I've told, this is a partly repetitious, and I will emphasize again, I think before you do that, what you really need as board and with your staff is to have a strategic planning session or sessions with or without a facilitator and be looking at where have we been and going way back, where are we now, where are we going, and where do we want to go, and that might not be the same. So I think it's like a self-evaluation process, and I think that's necessary before you do anything as far as further along these planning, because it has an impact on it. What do you want this village to be? So,
would you like a response to that, Mr. Ratuzic?
Sure.
Okay. We're one step ahead of you. We've we've acquired the pro bono services of a moderator who's going to guide us through a strategic planning process.
I'm glad for you. I'm happy to hear
And
you.
I emphasize the pro bono because I know you're very interested in that.
Okay. All right. I think there's anything else related to that. I'm extremely happy to hear that. But again, you might have a little time relative to that 57-quarter study to get and do the other thing first, because it might have some impact, which is supposed to. Because I understand you may want to do this on Webster as well, as sometime in the future has been proposed by the, I guess, by the Planning Commission or Economic Development Committee in the past. And planning is good, and such things are over planning, and there's, you have to dream, but sometimes I'm not indicting planners because my son-in-laws are a very good one for another municipality, but sometimes dreamers are too much dreamy and too idealistic and are not totally practical, which hopefully our politicians will be very practical. Thank you.
On a side note, before you sit down, congratulations on the article, and next time you go to Omaha, I'm going with you.
Okay. I'll bring a bottle of wine. Yeah, we're pretty proud of them.
Is there anyone who'd like to speak? You may speak on any item you wish. You only can take action on items listed in the business section of the agenda. And again, we're deferring items 7 and 9 until, or comment on 7 and 9 until we get to those items. Okay, hearing none, we will move on to item 6, 6A. Action regarding pool barriers. This is from the 19th of August, Ordinance 2014-21, amending Chapter 13, Building Code, Section 13.16D, relating to depth of portable pools. Is there a motion with regard to this item? Trustee Raptor?
I move to accept.
Is there a second? Trustee Guest?
All second.
Discussion? Roberts? We went through this. I see that it was 2012, but I think we addressed this even earlier than that. It must have been 5-6 years ago, before you came, Mark, about pools and fences and how big the pools had to be. And we actually angered some residents because they had these portable pools and they weren't going to put up a fence for a pool that they're going to take down every season. And so can you just sort of summarize for the people who are here what we're voting on in 6A?
Exactly what the problem was. Those, a lot of the people with the temporary pools put up there over 4 foot, 48 inches high, 4 foot high, we were still requiring a fence around it. So checking with the international codes and the international swimming pools and hot tub code enforcement, they don't require anybody to have a fence around a pool that's over 4 foot high. So my suggestion was get rid of it and make one change on there to go from 1 foot to 18 inches in depth of a pool. But that was the main problem. I was writing a lot of letters to people not having fences up, and I was getting a lot of negative feedback, and that's when I started looking into this. So. And I actually did a little research in between last time I was here. This time, with these other villages, towns, and cities, and it's about 50-50. And actually, a couple of them I talked to that noticed that they don't enforce the fence because they go by this and they're going to change the ordinance. Pulaski's the only one that they take require a extension. I don't know if you see that from here. It's just a little fence that goes around the top of the pool. But my suggestion would be just keep it. If it's 48 inches high, that's high enough. Somebody couldn't be able to climb over it as long as they got the removable ladder or they can lock it so somebody can't get to climb up on it.
Okay, so 6A, we're really talking about changing from portable pools over 1 foot to portable pools over 18 inches in depth must be drained, fenced, or covered in such a manner as to provide public safety after each day's use. Right?
Right. Yep.
So what we're doing is increasing the depth of the pool that you can have.
Well, it was actually because we had one section that said 1 foot, and another one said 18 inches.
Oh, okay.
The requirement is the state is 18 inches.
Okay, all right. So 6A is just a housekeeping thing that cleans up the fact that we had misquoted in one part. It's not actually changing the ordinance.
Right. Well, we are changing a bit. Yeah, it is. We're rewording it. It was actually what the last paper's red line. We got like the second page rewrote it.
He's yeah, that's section B, but he's just talking about section A.
I'm talking about 6A only.
I'm sorry, which section?
We're on item 6A in the agenda. So it's ordinance 2014-21.
Oh. Right, that was the 18 inches.
Yep.
Just added from 1 foot 18 inches.
And the reason that we did that is we're not really changing the ordinance. It was different in different parts of the code book, right? So it's a housekeeping thing.
Sorry, I misunderstood.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Any further questions? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. 6B, ordinance 2014-22, amending Chapter 26, Fences, Section 26.08B, and creating Section 26.08C, relating to swimming pool fences and on-ground residential pool structures. Is there a motion with regard to this item? We'll hear from Mr. Roberts.
I'll make that motion.
Trustee Harris, and then seconded by Trustee Genrich.
Yes.
Discussion now, Mr. Roberts. We're talking about the.
Sorry, I got ahead of myself.
That's all right.
This is one where the 4 foot pool, if it's 4 foot, it meets requirement for international codes, which is actually worldwide codes for swimming pools. That you wouldn't need a fence around it as long as it's 4 foot, and the ladder can be removed or secured for nobody to climb into the pool.
So I know we've been talking about this in 2012, and then I know before that, and child safety is the primary purpose of all this, but were there any liability implications for any of this as well, for the village?
As far as I know, no, sir. It's the I know insurance companies don't like it, but there's no extra requirement. It says international code, that's the way all the code is across the world, that 4 foot is acceptable.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Item number 7. 7A, action regarding the intergovernmental agreement regarding LeBrun Street with the pier. Resolution 2014-16, authorizing intergovernmental cooperation agreement between the City of De Pere and the Village of Alloway to determine a portion of the county boundary line through detachment and annexation of territory. Is there a motion with regard to this item, or would you like to suspend the rules and hear from Mr. Rent?
Resolution was already adopted. Are we keeping it, or are we changing it with the...
Well, that's why, that's what we want to talk with Craig.
Item A, there was the resolution that you amended at the last board action, which was to add into that a provision of approval by the Village of Alloway for any access. What was done following that board meeting, and in the handout you have in your packet, on the second page, number one, the original agreement for paragraph 5 is at the top of the page. The proposed new language, which is number 2 over item B, was what De Pere offered back as an alternative to the first paragraph. And that added some additional features in there, or provisions where Alloway would have input to a decision that would be made to provide access to LeBrun. We countered with the last paragraph, revised proposed new language, item 3 or paragraph C. We countered back with a further definition of how costs would be handled and access and so forth. And the net result of that was, and it's attached in the in the email on the next page, it appears that any language limiting that authority in the annexation attachment agreement is not acceptable. And they stated, we remain willing to agree with the language, original language of paragraph 5, or the city's proposed changes to paragraph 5 that was previously forwarded. That's paragraph B on the previous page. So that's where we're at. The only other information I can offer on it that I'm aware of is we did ask their planner for his viewpoint on what he thought would be requested in the future for access. And again, it's his observation or his comments, it's not an official agreement. But his thought was that if they requested access, it would be at the end of the existing roadway, right by the parking lot. If there was access requested by a developer further east, as that property continues, the pier would require that developer to pay for the cost of the road, the trail relocation, and the access point, which would be, in his comment, a prohibitive cost, and make that somewhat unlikely that that would occur. So anyway, that's where we're at. And that's basically what's on the table, is what to do with paragraph 5 of that agreement, whether you're willing to accept either the original paragraph or the peer's proposed modified paragraph, or there's some other alternative.
So 7A, is basically in place. Item 7A, resolution 2014-16, and what you're wondering is if this board wants to change it to either item B, which was a counter-proposal by DePere,
right,
or C, which was our counter to their counter-proposal.
No.
Which they refused.
Right. Yeah, they refused.
They refused that.
They refused C.
Yeah, they refused C.
Why would we want to do this? I know that all of you talked about this last time when I wasn't here, but if they're pretty sure that they're only going to need one access point, and that it's very unlikely there'll be a request for a second one east of the parking lot, then why wouldn't they just accept C?
I suppose because it is a limitation, and from a legal standpoint, they prefer not to have any limits placed on them.
Okay.
Just my sense that we might want to take the public comment, and suspend the rules. But I think we have a more full and frank discussion about this in closed session, perhaps. Because we're essentially negotiating a provision in an intergovernmental agreement. So I think that would be more appropriate for a closed session, where we can discuss things and negotiation tactics or strategy and not be burdened by if you're knowing what we're talking about and what we're thinking as we're trying to negotiate this language with them. So I think we should have a full session to review the whole process and figure out what our strategy is and what position we're going to take with the city of here.
Okay. Any further comment with regard to this before we open Trustee Dart?
Just a question. The goal, what's our goal about doing that road in the first place? I've forgotten.
One of the primary reasons that we have these agreements on the table is to two things. One is to upgrade the roadway, repair the roadway. But if DePere participates in the upgrade of the roadway, as it presently sits, because they have half the right-of-way, they are compelled to construct a full roadway with sidewalk. By conveying their portion of this right-of-way to Alloway, we can repair the roadway with the peer sharing in the cost without the construction of the sidewalk or the trail at this point in time, but they agree that they'll participate with us in the application for funding for a trail and participate in the cost, the local share cost, ultimately connected to Weezy Park and the East River Trail. So it's more of a technicality, if you will, but it allows them to work with us in a better fashion.
But are we saying that if we didn't want to do the road at all, there's no real reason we want to except for De Pere wants to?
I guess if we don't want to do anything with the roadway...
I mean, do we? I don't...
Well, we do need to repair the road. Yes.
We need to repair.
We need to repair. This was part of the mechanism to get to the point where we can, in fact, do that.
And right now, Craig, if we didn't do anything and De Pere wanted to create access and put a road down where we have the trail, do they have the right to do that?
On their half of the right of way.
So if they wanted to create access to the road or the trail, they could do so?
Yeah, on their half, yes.
Okay. Why are we annexing their half of the road? If this is an agreement and we're just going to, why would we be annexing the De Pere half of the road at all? So it's an intergovernmental agreement that we're going to agree to move forward in a particular manner. Why are we?
Because they feel that if they participate in the project and it's half of the right of way is theirs, then the road has to be upgraded to their design standard for a city street, including sidewalks.
Oh.
And they have strong opposition to the sidewalk in that, road.
Why is that?
From their residents in that area.
Residents, yes. And when we had the public meeting here, it was 70% of Pere residents against doing anything with the road because they didn't want to be assessed for sidewalk.
Oh, they would be assessed, so that's why they don't want
to be assessed, yes. Or the roadway and the sidewalk.
So they'd rather give up the property altogether than to have to put sidewalk in according to their ordinances.
Yes.
Okay, any further questions? Is there a motion with regard to this item? They're obviously all connected, 7A through 7C. Is there a motion with regard? Oh, I'm sorry, yes, I'm sorry, thank you. Unless there are objections, we'll suspend the rules. Is there anyone who would like to speak? Mr. Robson, would you like to speak? Please, Mr. Robson, I'd like to hear from you. Not that I don't want to hear from you, Mr. Matuszak.
My name is Don Robson. I live at 807 LeBrun. Actually, the only house on the section of the road that we're talking about. You know, now that the city of De Pere has decided to reject our proposal of not allowing them access, I really think it's time for this board to reevaluate what we want to do with that road, because I don't think it's in the dire straits that Mr. Burnt thinks it is, at least not down in front of my house it isn't. You know, De Pere has constantly been trying to push things on us throughout this whole process. I mean, when Craig talks about how there was so much opposition to the sidewalks, De Pere's response was, then, well, let's put them on the alleyway side. I'm talking about from where it's closed on McCaslin up to Lyman Street. You know, now they're talking about this trail, this paved trail, and rather than put it on the De Pere side, now they want to push it over on my side of the road. You know, you're going to have to fill in my drainage ditch, and then what's going to happen to, you know, my ability to drain my property if we allow that to happen? It just seems to me that it's constant with De Pere of always wanting something. And now they're willing to give up a piece of property that they could care less about. They don't need that road for anything. They don't use it for anything. They don't maintain their half of the road. They don't plow it in the winter. They don't repair it, and I'm talking about filling the potholes. They don't cut the grass in the ditch on the site. We do that. Alloway does that. And as far as I know, we are not getting paid for that. We're just doing it because they won't. And so what they're doing, I think, is dumping a piece of property on us that we really don't need. We have the road there. I understand down by the Yardway site, there is the road is in tough shape, and I know that it takes repair every year. But up, you know, in front of my house, if the potholes were filled, it would be just fine. I don't need any more than that. And so I'm really concerned, and I think what I would like to have this board do is to just completely reject this proposal with DePere. Let's forget about that completely. And the other thing I would do is insist, and I can't stress the word insist enough, that they start taking care of their obligations on that road, and maybe they'll change their tune a little bit. If we stop doing it, you know, we'll take care of our half, that's fine. But why are we taking care of their property? And now they want to dump it on us, you know. I mean, I understand that's not going to change what we're doing. But it just seems to me that we are constantly being asked by DePere to do things that we, as a village, I don't think want to do. And I think it's at the point where we are so frustrated with what's going on with LeBron, we can't get anything done. And I'm at the point where let's just tell DePere, no, we're not going to do anything with the road. And I thank you for listening to me.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
I share cars from 2680 all the way to West Avenue. I share some of Tom's position for us on the storm because I don't live down there, but in my view of what I've seen here, correct me if I'm wrong, scenario is that we wanted to improve the road, there was options considered, and DePere said, well, you can have the road if you want to pave it, which we said, fine, but they are now attaching conditions where they want their cake and want to eat it too. I don't think they should have the degree of control that they want once they give the land up. But I have a question for Craig. Is there sufficient room on our side to put in a paved roadway and ignore the deer side? Could it be widened to the north without a huge cost? That ditch creates a problem. But anyhow, I think you should stand firm and not accede to their wishes with the degree of control that they want. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak with regard to this issue? Hearing none, we'll take up the rules. Is there a motion with regard to 7A? Trustee Guest.
I would move that we postpone further discussion of this until the next meeting to be discussed in closed session in terms of what our response and position should be.
Is there a second?
No second.
Trustee Genrich seconds. Discussion?
I mean, I just think that, you know, they're closed session items because of the contract negotiations. I think the board in closed session wants to determine. I've heard some proposals made, maybe we just don't do anything. I just leave it alone. You know, maybe put up a Berlin Wall down the middle. You know. But I think we need to revisit the whole concept in the context of these negotiations to see if we want to continue with them and under what terms. So I think that's better served in a closed session where DePere just doesn't know what our strategy is until we tell them what it is.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
That's cool. I was just going to say something, but that's okay.
You sure?
Yeah. Well, it's not going to impact this, but I watched the DePere TV, and they were talking about this very issue. And it didn't seem... They brought it up as an afterthought. One person brought it up as an afterthought about needing access to that in case there's a development. So I don't know that they were, you know, trying to screw us, for lack of a better word, but I don't know. It just didn't seem like they were really trying to do anything. And I'm not as close to it as you are, Don, so.
I'm not so close. Can I speak?
Please do. We'll suspend the rules.
I'm not sure you understand, you know, what access might mean down there. And we're going through this on the upper closed portion right now, with Harry Mocha wanting to build on that big parcel that he has in that closed section. What he needs, and he owns property. If you go down into the area where Wheezy Park is, you will see that there's a cul-de-sac already put in there, and that's where Harry wants to build. And he's got the same problem there that he does on the upper section, in that he needs dry land access. And believe me, we've been through this years ago. LeBrun, in its present state, will never qualify for dry land access. It's too low. It needs to be raised about 3 feet to make dry land access. And you know, I can tell, or you could tell if you came down there, you would see the difference in the height of the condominiums across the street from me.
Yeah.
It may be more than 3 feet. And my concern is down where Pecatonica Court comes in down there, where he's going to build almost, their backyards would butt up against the trail that goes straight east along, you know, I think that's part of the piers. That conceivably could all be raised 3 feet all the way up to until they hit dry land access. And that's my main concern. If they raise that road 3 feet in front of my house, I'm in a hole. And I can't raise my house. I can't raise my garage. I can't raise my storage building. I'm going to lose trees and everything else. And you know, the cost to me to bring in fill to even raise my yard would be astronomical, I think. And that's my fear. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but I understand how this works and how Harry Mocha works, in that he's tried this before and we've rejected it before. The village has rejected this before, even though he offered to give the village $50,000 to raise that road. The village said, no, you can't put me in a hole. That's not fair. And my fear is that if he needs dry land access down there, that whole road has got to come up. You can't just raise the piers half of the road. We're going to have to raise our half too. And then think about what your yardway site is going to look like down there. Now you're going to be driving down into the hole, and it's already a muddy mess when it rains. So it's all the property along there. It's not just me. You know, it's everybody, including the village that owns property down there. And that's my fear. And I've seen them try it before, and I just feel like by keeping this access point, that's what they're looking for in the future. If, in fact, they build houses down there and they need dry land access, that's what they're holding on to this access point for. And that's why I am opposed to allowing that. You know, if we can get the road without it giving them any access, that's another story. But at this point, to allow them to have an access point, I'm just really nervous about it.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak while we have suspended the rule? Yes, sir.
I forgot one thing. North of the pier, saying, well, if we improve it, we have to put curb and gutter and sidewalk according to our ordinances. It would appear to me that they could very easily modify that to accomplish that. It's a, sounds like a cop-out. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to speak with regard to this issue? Okay, we'll take up the rules. Is there a motion with regard to this item? We didn't get all the way through that process yet.
Sorry. Yeah, there was a motion and a second.
Yes.
Right. We didn't vote on it. Right. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries to postpone. Do you want to take 7B and C at the same time?
I think that those should be postponed as well, because I think they turn upon A.
That's what I'm thinking. So I would say that you want to take 7B and C together?
I would want to take 7B and C.
Is there a motion with regard to items 7B and C?
To postpone it for closed session discussion at the next meeting, and then we'll deal with them all openly after that.
Is there a second? Trustee Dart seconds. Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Item 8, action regarding the Fox River Corridor Study, RFT. Is there a motion with regard to this item?
I'd ask that we hear from Trevor first.
You want, and we have a recommendation to suspend the rules and hear from Trevor first? Okay, we'll suspend the rules. Trevor, this isn't enough information for you.
A couple questions about the information.
Okay.
So at the last meeting, we asked permission to put together an RFP for a corridor study for the Riverside Drive, both for the Greater Alloway planning study, but specifically now we're focusing on Riverside Drive. Brad, myself, and Dave, we put this one together. The only things that are missing are detailed maps, and we're working on that, and I'll be inserted before it goes out. And then also on page 11 at the end, what's the recommendation of our attorney to take out the last paragraph?
Okay. Trustee Harris?
I had a couple questions about the dates regarding the submittal deadline. Is it, I see we're giving them 2 months to put together the proposal. Would we want to move it? I don't know if there's a something established for these sorts of things where we look at 60 days, or if we'd want to move it up a little bit so that if we don't have it till the 12th, we can't even look at it formally until the 18th. If we did something towards the very end of October, at least we'd be able to look at it at the first meeting in November. And then secondly, if we'd want to change the initial phase of work from the end of August, again, moving forward a little bit, I don't know what amount of time it would really take them to get this done. If we work through and we're able to get this approved still this calendar year, if we moved it up even to June 30th, that gives them 6 months to complete the work. And the sooner we know findings, the sooner we're able to act on it.
The November 12th deadline, I just kind of picked down because I didn't want it to be any further past that. Do you, I don't know if you want to weigh on the exact timelines of the RFPs that he's been involved with these longer than I have.
The November 12th is somewhat arbitrary. If we would give a consultant a 30-day response time, I think that's sufficient. We have, as Trevor said, we want to insert the maps, just do a little bit of cleanup. So we could adjust that date to a 30-day response. I think that's very reasonable. This is not a like a full city study or something like that, where sometimes the timelines need to be longer for the consultant to really be involved. But I think 30 days is reasonable. And then an adjustment on the tail end. If we move it up a little bit, I don't think that is as important based on what the DOT was just saying. Because they're talking about next summer. Well, first, they have two different deadlines, but they were talking about, I wrote the dates down, but they were first talking about some of the information that they want up front, which I think once we select a consultant, we would emphasize the importance of communicating with staff and the DOT on their work to make sure our consultant is up to speed. But when it comes to a final phase in August of next year, a lot of times that final work is printing the document and putting the binding on. I wouldn't say that final date would be as important, but again, easy enough to adjust that up a month if we let the bid out a month earlier.
I think getting the feedback a little sooner would help us just have the information. Some of it would be if there are any some of the ideas that we may have talked about along Riverside. Just the sooner the better. I don't want to push it along and not get good information and rush someone, but I don't know if it's realistic that it's going to take 8+ months to complete.
Tell you the truth, I'm still a little bit confused about the DOT timeline. I saw in the presentation that it was going to be winter, spring of 2015 when the preferred alternative is sort of decided on. And then I thought I heard someone say summer when the preferred alternative is decided on. It's a pretty much a foregone conclusion that the preferred alternative, which is sort of this general, do we want 4 lanes median or 4 lanes no median, will be decided on before any sort of consultant could give us feedback on a study. Is that correct?
Well, I think what I heard, and Craig can adjust accordingly, I heard them say that this winter, early spring, they would have this preferred alternative to present. The dates after that would be a planning term that we should be tweaking. And I think when you said once that planning term came, that alternative came forward, that alternative is going to be carried forward, and it'll be massaged. But that's what I have for a date is this winter, really, what I was thinking. This winter they want to have commitment from the village to say median turn lanes, those things that affect their design. Summer 2015 is when they start final design to start the environmental impact. That's when they have to send their information to the DNR, federal government, figuring out what their paperwork has to say for the environmental impact. So I think that's why they picked the alternative in winter, tweak it, send it in with the rest of the paperwork for this environmental impact, and then it's another year for detailed design. That's what I, so I think that's where I got the 2016 for their design work to be done. Mm-hmm. So I think we do.
But
have
this study would have no implications for what the preferred alternative is. It would only have implications for the details of the design.
Well, I think there is a small window to bring a consultant on and to get an initial reaction. Because if we bring a consultant on, I'm sorry. Could you put a date on for when we start this study?
First of the year because we have the budget impacts.
Okay. So what the staff was just talking about was a first of the year start because of budget impacts. And I think what I heard was, so if we have a consultant, we get him in the door in January as soon as possible. We could even submit any information that we have from the DOT to the preferred consultant before they come and make a site visit to say, this is so you know what you're going to be working under, here is all of the material. And I think we could have a consultant in here to review it and offer us an opinion before we have to sign off with the DOT on a preferred alternative. He would not be intimately involved with what's gone on in the last year because we missed that chance. But I do believe there would be the ability to bring a consultant in and say, what's your first blush on this preferred alternative?
Trustee Dart?
I don't really think we get that much of a say on the preferred alternative. It doesn't sound like, unless we had some great reason why. You know, I don't think a consultant's going to change what the preferred alternative is.
No, but it might change some of the minutia of the plan ultimately. Like you were talking about marine park.
Right.
I mean,
and that comes
there could be some alterations.
When I was asking about the timeline and that, it sounded like they're really going to decide the preferred alternative, and we work from there, and then they can accommodate whatever we. I don't know exactly how they'll accommodate, but they can work into that plan.
Mr. Burke?
In the spring of 2015, the preferred alternative will be fairly well defined, but there will be some tweaking of that. What they called the environmental document, which was listed as summer of 2015, that's not the final design, but that is the design alternative that would incorporate in any revisions that you would want based on this study. Because that environmental document is what goes to the state and ultimately gets approved, and then that's what goes to final design. So if you're going to modify the Marine Street access, ideally it should be in the environmental document. That concept should be in there. They said they could do it later as well, but they would prefer to have it in the environmental document because that document will define where the sidewalks are and where the bike lanes are, and then all of the intersections and so forth and any stoplights, roundabouts, whatever, will be in that environmental document. My guess is that will be August, September, maybe as late as October in 2015, but that environmental document is what will ultimately get built. There'll be design revisions as they go on, but that'll be 98% of what's going to be constructed. So that's your timeline, between now and June, July, somewhere in there, to get the feedback back to that.
Okay. And just to talk a little bit more about the timeline for the corridor study, if we've got a 30-day window, so that puts us into mid-October, the response is coming back, then what we're going to be looking at is a committee to review all the proposals, bring in the final two, three maybe, to do a formal probably presentation to a review committee, then make that potential offer to them through the board. So you do have a probably a rather long process between the 30 day and the mid-October to when they'll actually get started. And again, that's probably going to be pushing you closer to the first of the year. You know, the other option that the board does have, obviously, is charging some of the funds or all the funds for the corridor study to the TIF. If you're doing that process, obviously you have the opportunity to start the work on it sooner. So those are some options. But I think the timing of this, and Matthew, I think you're absolutely right here, Jesse Harris, sorry, to cut it down to a 30-day window is going to still push us close to the first of the year before we're really starting to put some fun process into this.
How would you react to Mr. Matusik's comments? One, that this is a costly proposition. What do we get for this study? I'm assuming it's going to cost us a little bit of money. What do we get for it that we can't get from all the work that we've been doing with the DOT and talking with residents and having them create alternative scenarios? How does the consultant go above and beyond that?
Dave's been more involved in
absolutely
studies. Well, I guess one of the first things we've had, how many generations of opinions and ideas that ambiguously float. What a consultant does is he takes these plans that have been done by the county, take the ideas of the stakeholders and of the board and the staff, and solidify these ideas into a solid plan, into a formal presentation, and influence those ideas, which might be just ideas floating out there, into a material drawing, so you can say, I have an aha moment. This is what Riverside looks like. This is what Alloway looks like. So what that consultant does, like a facilitator, but a good consultant would take this and give you a concise text and give you a nice illustration of all of these ideas that have floated around for an indefinite amount of time. So it gives us something to walk out of the room with. It gives us something to present to a future developer with clarity, not just my ideas.
Okay. And then what about the idea of hiring the county, planners in the county, or Green Bay, or I don't think the Beer Mike is going to be interested, but to help out with something like this? We used the county some years ago, and they used to provide us as many things as they could for free, and then they got to the point where they had to charge us, and now I don't even think they have time to charge us to do some of the work. So that would be my initial reaction, is they don't have capacity to help with some of these, especially in this level of detail. Is that
you're absolutely right. What's happened with the county is exactly that. They're used to provide a free service. It was also Bay Lakes Regional Planning used to be on the scene more with that type of activity. So exactly what you summarized is what's happened. They used to do it for free. They did all of the comprehensive, or quite a few of the comprehensive plans around Brown County when the Smart Growth Initiative came out. And again, with loss of staff time, they're not farming their services out.
they're offering advice on something if need be, but they're not farming out their services. When it comes to the city, they've hired consultants to do their plans. They're, again, they're short staffed. They're less than they were a couple years ago. They hire out for it.
Thank you. Excuse me. Trustee Harris.
I think one other thing that we should consider is sending out the RFP doesn't obligate us to spend any money. We're not spending any money aside from preparing it. It gives us a figure to use of what's the cost for getting this service. I think if we come back with something that's $800,000 to do the study, we're going to think differently. But until we send it out, we don't know what those potential charges could be.
And also based on that discussion, what Brad was talking about, we develop a short list, say three consultants. We get a presentation from those three consultants. One of the things that we've asked in this RFP is to show the experience that they've had that would be similar to what we're asking for. So it does help to draw that mental image to say, this is truly what the consultants will be bringing to us to help us realize this future that we hope we have.
Trustee Rounder.
Do we ask for examples of their previous work?
Yes.
It does say that? Okay, I didn't see that.
Trustee, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay.
I thought you were finished. Go ahead.
So we do. Okay. Finish for now. I'll be back.
Trustee Dennis.
My concern is that I would like to see the chronological layout of both our RFP as well as the 57 project so that they pair up and match up. And I would like to see something more than just our discussion here of, some of this, some of that. I would like to see, and that's what I said before about the drop-dead dates, because things too easily slip away. And although we say we don't get a big input in this, small adjustments make big changes. And we should be able to take our input wherever we can along the way, and we should be able to match up the time frames so that we can look at this and have an idea of where they are and where they want to be and where we are and where we want to be, so that even though we may not intersect very often, that we will at least be on a parallel program and everybody understanding on both sides what we have and what we want, what they have and what they want, and where we can and can't work together and what we will need to look at the problems might arise. And so I would like to be able to see that chronologically as well as, it will unfold as it goes out, but I want to make sure that we all get on the same page time-wise so things don't slip through.
Yeah.
I was just going to make another comment. I have reached out to Brown County. Cole and I have been going back and forth trying to find a date that works for us where we can sit down and kind of go over what we're envisioning with our RFP. What is it that maybe Brown County can assist in?
The fact that you're having a hard time establishing a date might tell you something about their their capacity to actually, I appreciate that, though. I really do. It was my impression that I saw this transition during the course of the past 9 years, where at first we were using them for quite a lot, and then they just couldn't do it anymore.
And I like what Clarence, Mr. Matusik said earlier. The identifying who we are, where we've been, where we want to be, or where we're going, and that is a charge of this consultant as well. By interviewing the stakeholders, property owners along the corridor, reaching out to the board, reaching out to residents, and really trying to find out what is it that makes Alloy and what is it that you want it to make Alloy. So a lot of that is brought into the whole the corridor study, the vision, what you've got arranged with the facilitator. Exactly. All this stuff does tie together very well.
Yeah. So I was thinking about what Mr. Matusik said. I'm not sure that it needs to happen in that order, that we have to have a vision and a strategic plan and then decide on what Riverside might look like, those processes might be able to take place in parallel. But I think I do think we should sort of get together and talk about that strategic planning, those strategic planning efforts. I have a few questions about the RFP itself. Do we have evaluative criteria in terms of like a rubric, or is there a weighting system to what they could expect in terms of evaluation? I mean, on a lot of grants, they'll say, look, 50% of this is about cost, and 20% is about this, and 20% is about that. So the proposers know where to spend their efforts in the RFP. The way that I saw it listed, we're going to have an evaluation committee decide using some evaluation criteria who the successful candidate is.
What we're looking at doing is through the last process that I went through to select the consultant for the Fox River Trail connection, there's a very defined method that they utilize. We're trying to utilize very similar to that method. Specific questions relating to staff, experience of staff, availability of staff. So they're all ranked, and points are associated for every one of those line items. Past projects, similar projects, not just past projects, but similar projects.
So is it actually a quantitative rating scale where they get a rating on each of these dimensions and then you add them all up? And
you bet.
Okay. Is there wiggle room for miscellaneous? Because one of the problems with some of these instruments is one scores a 78 and the other scores a 77, and then are you locked into choosing the 78 when there might be compelling reasons not to?
Well, that's why if we're looking at about five different evaluators on this, so then you can start to have a better, a more broad, defined number of where these consultants are lining up. Are they a 77 or are they a 78? We have five different individuals ranking them. One of the biggest society factors is the cost. That's a huge factor. And we're keeping that out of the picture at this point. That's going to be a separate item that at the very end, okay, then we open up your cost factor.
Okay. Under G for deliverables, probable cost, do we want that to be itemized by G2 on page 7, probable cost of implementing major recommendations in the project? I would imagine we don't want just an overall cost, or we want it to break down those costs by itemized.
I would assume that would be itemized.
Okay, I would suggest we just add that.
Sure.
The final report for G7, do we need any details about what we expect in that report? I would imagine it would be, the results of the study would be in the report, but I wonder if we have something more in mind to make sure that we get a report that meets our needs instead of whatever they decide to give us.
Yeah, I think maybe you need to just go back and define what are those.
Wanted
the land uses. Taking everything and just throwing it back in. This is your final project must include all these aspects.
I think so, the final report. Yeah.
Well, they're usually one of the most telling points with these consultants. I can't remember with Bob or Jim or who said it, but we're going to be able to see some of their past work product.
Right.
I mean, when I evaluate consultants, that's the first thing I go to is what have you done for other people and what's it look like and how detailed is it, or is it just cookie cutter stuff and you just change the name?
Right.
And it's always, in my mind, the most important evaluator tool, which is what have you done before and what's it look like and how professional is it.
And I don't see that in here.
Of those that are on the selection committee would need to check with references.
Right.
Because you certainly want to do that.
And then G4, I would just change provide the first word to the word AN, just for parallel structure. And then, Brad, I had one extra question for you about the evaluation process. Will the respondents to the RFP, is there any weighting of these different factors? So the number of similar projects that you've done before, you get a rating from 1 to 5. I'm not sure what your rating scheme is like. Are there certain elements of the proposal that are weighted heavier than other elements?
Typically, yes.
Okay.
You can find that you'll have 12 questions total, 12 ranking questions.
Yeah.
And they could be evaluated anywhere from, say, 4 points to 15 to 20.
Okay.
All right. So, yeah, some are going to pass projects, similar projects, along this same study would be one of the biggest things that would...
It'll be weighted more heavily.
More than you have enough staff, because that's a very important issue too, but some of the smaller aspects would be certainly less point value.
And will the respondents know that weighting scale? So will they know that their past work is going to be considered twice as much as some other factor, or is that just for the purposes of the review committee?
My experience has been it's the review committee obligation to keep that from them. But Craig, Dave, have you had any other scenarios where you provided the rating system?
I wouldn't say that we would want to provide the rating system because it's like giving the answer. But one of the things, the way this is built, is a consultant is encouraged to call to ask questions about the RFP. And I think in that process, in what would turn into a phone interview, a good consultant would know to ask the questions of Brad, you know, help explain Alloy's ultimate goal of what they're trying to achieve in this. So a good consultant would be able to educate themselves to help put together a good package.
Right.
But again, that just like a job interview, the consultant shouldn't see exactly what the rating is, because basically they could cheat.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with that. I think sometimes, you know, a consultant might only give you a couple of pieces of work from that they've done before, and if they know that that's really important to you, then they might give you 4 or 5. And if they don't know that's important to you, you might not be getting their best foot forward, because they don't know which foot you want them to put forward. So I'm not telling you how you have to do it, but you might want to think about how much whether you give them the rating scale or not. I don't know if that makes any sense, but to have some document that tells them that these things are really very primarily important to us, and these things are also important, but maybe not as much as the ones that came before. Or to give them some sense of what's important to us. I don't think it's cheating at all. I think it's letting them know how to present their qualifications. And you can't make up qualifications. If you don't have good work that you've done before, you can't just generate it. So, Trustee Harris.
Excuse me. Two questions on the Dave. You said call up and talk with Brad. Wouldn't we limit the discussions, for lack of better words, to email, so that any other potential bidders get the same response? Do we have to keep it open in terms of who's getting what information? And then the other one had to do with the evaluation process and any trips to do presentations. We're saying the costs are borne by the village. I don't know if that's the normal practice, and if we want to set some sort of limit on those costs.
First, I guess the very first one, and Brad and I haven't talked about this, but were you under B, introduction, questions for clarification concerning the RFP directed to Brad? My take on this, and it will be followed up with a discussion on Brad, is that he would have a script to operate from, to make sure we give each consultant the same information. That's the way I would do it, so that I don't forget something important from one consultant to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if it's asked for by email, same kind of thing, that email would be a template so that each consultant is getting the same information.
Okay. I've bid on different government projects as part of my full-time job, and you can, all the different respondents send in questions of clarification, and everyone who is bidding on it gets the responses so that it does stay open. I don't know if that's the same process.
Like I said, I hadn't talked to Brad about this because he has his own experience, but that was what I was thinking, just to avoid ambiguity in answers.
And you are correct on that. That should have been removed.
Oh, on which part should be removed?
The village born, bearing the fee, or being responsible.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Trustee Rafter?
Two quick points. On page 8, C, number 2, it says relevant projects under description of firm. We ask for relevant projects the firm has done. I'm guessing that's where we're asking for the examples of the work. My fear would be they may just list, because I've seen responses to other RFPs where they list the projects, but they don't give you any examples of their work. We might want to ask explicitly for examples of their work on those projects. And then I know at the last, or I think at the last meeting, we discussed while we're concentrating on the Riverside corridor right now, we know we're going to be looking at Webster. We know we have a connector somewhere in between. And we're talking about the possibility of asking them to consider, at least from a very high conceptual view, a vision for the two corridors and tying them together, but not going into detail on anything except the Riverside project, because it's really one vision for Alloway. I didn't see that in there. Or does my memory not work? That's possible.
We thought that was in there, but I can look it over, and we definitely want to include that. Right.
And if they itemize that, we could either say yeah or no, mm-hmm. but at least we're getting them to think the large vision.
That's why we brought this to you.
And if you reference it here, that this request for RFP is asked that the consultant considers the other two phases, mm-hmm. or at least we're referencing it.
I think in our last meeting that we talked about making sure we specifically broke them into the three pieces so that we would have the first portion expedited and broken up funding-wise that way as well, mm-hmm. and that it was just a very short synopsis summary overview of what they would do in the other sections while concentrating on making sure that the primary development, the expediency needed for the corridor, for the highway as well, was what we were actually focusing
on. Yeah, just from a vision, you know, we were talking earlier about why have this big study done, and I used to live in a town in Illinois called Arlington Heights, and it used to be a downtown area of very one-story, very boring. It was a downtown that was four blocks in diameter, and it was going down the tubes. It was dying. And they went out and they brought in a consultant to create a vision and bring in all the stakeholders, local business people, and they took it to the public, they took it to developers, and they came out with this vision. And today Arlington Heights is probably one of the most lively neighborhoods in all of Chicagoland. So it's to get buy-in from the community. It gets the community, at least in this experience, got the community very excited. And it really, I personally thought it helped a lot.
So do you want to see that fleshed out more in the document than it is right now?
I think just if we can ask a little more explicitly, we would like to see just a high level of pulling in the two corridors, and you know, even at just a visual or conceptual. We don't need any details because we'll spend that later.
Anything further? We do not have a motion yet. So do you feel like you have all of the recommended changes to the document?
I think so. I mean, I guess one question from the board needs to get be able to put together a selection committee ourselves, or do you want us to come back and ask you for that?
Now, when I entertain a motion in a couple of seconds as to whether or not we should proceed with the RFP, I would ask whoever makes the motion to include whether or not the staff could put together their own selection committee. And my recommendation would be that we let them put together the committee and get moving rather than having to take it back to the board. That's my opinion.
Wasn't the discussion, too, that the time frame for a response would be mid-October in lieu of mid-November?
Is there a motion with regard to this item? Trustee Gast?
I'll make a motion that staff be authorized to issue the request for proposal for phase one of this project schedule, incorporating the changes discussed at board with a return date for the request for proposals of October 15th of 2014, and that the village administrator, in conjunction with staff, be charged with the responsibility of developing a review committee that will actually review the RFPs as they come up.
Is there a second? Trustee Rafter seconds. Discussion? Anything else that you need in this conversation?
Is that it's 1 day less than a month. Is that enough for you to prepare and get it out? You need a little more time.
15th is a Wednesday.
That's Friday.
The 17th then? Trustee Gast, 17th, is that right?
That would be fine.
Trustee Rafter? Trustee Harris, please.
Did we come to a conclusion on when we would want the project completed? I threw out a couple of different options of dates, but I don't know if we settled. What's in here currently is the August 31st date. I don't know what day we want to use as an ending point. My suggestion was
the idea was the person would start January 1st, right? Or maybe before, if we decided we want to use TIF funds to get the project started. What are we looking at for time to do this? 6 months from start to finish? Is that what we're looking at?
6 months would be fair.
So July 1st at the latest, is that?
Just didn't know if we decided upon that. So
I know, but you're right, we haven't.
June 30th, July 1st, I'm fine with either one of those.
June 30th, let's say. End of the. Trustee Gast, is that okay for understanding for your motion?
Yes, that's right.
Trustee Rafter?
Yep.
Anything further? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Nice work, Trevor.
Good job.
Item 9, action regarding request from Ron Munyon for extension allowing two sex offenders to reside in one residence. This is from December 3rd from 2013, where the village agreed to postpone from issuing any citation for a violation of a residency density restriction code to Mr. Munyon, provided that he relocate from 337 Beaufort Street on or before September 1st. 2014. I'm going to suspend the rules and entertain some comments from folks here, and I think Mr. Munyon is here himself, so I'm going to give Mr. Munyon the floor first if you'd like to make any comments. Sir.
Hello. I'm Ron Munyon, and well, first off, I can't find a place to live. I've been trying everywhere. I've made a list of every place that I've been looking at and checked into, and nobody wants to rent to me. I don't know what to do. I did talk with my landlord, and he said my wife could stay there, and I can keep paying rent there for them, and I got to find a place myself. I'm about ready to declare myself homeless because I don't know what else to do. But if you will...
I made copies of all this for everybody just to show you all that I don't know what to do. Nobody wants to rent to me anymore. I've checked out 38 places in the last 3.5 months. Now I know I probably should have looked back in December when you first allowed that. But the landlord told me not to, so like June, July, because this way it had till September.
Basically, I don't know what to do. I don't know if I could get any help from the village on trying to help me find something affordable. Where to go? I thought I was going to stay with my brother-in-law and the Swabenon, but the Swabenon will not let me back in there because I'm no longer grandfathered in. Green Bay will no longer let me back in there because I'm no longer grandfathered in. My only choices is Alloway, DePere, and Howard. And Howard's going to be the same thing. They don't rent to sex offenders. So I'm in a bad situation, and I don't know what to do. So that's why I readdressed this. About a month and a half ago, I did contact you, Mr. Van Den Bond, and I never got a return call. So I just tried to proceed looking for a place, you know, and I couldn't find anything. And I came to the board a couple weeks ago and asked them again. I said, what can I do? I don't want to go to jail for not having a place to live. And that's the way the ordinance, not Alloway's ordinance, but the sex offender ordinance basically says if I don't have a place to live, I go to jail. And that's not right for trying to provide for my family. That's not right at all. So I ask you, either can you give me some more time or can you help me try to find a place? And I don't know what else to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Is there anyone else who'd like to speak with regard to this issue?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Pinkert. I reside at 345 Bowery Street. At the present time, on Bowery Street, from 140 Bowery Street down to 339 Bowery Street, we have three sex offenders living. That's a very high density in that small area. The person here, I live right next door to him, very irresponsible, in my opinion. He had over 9 months to procure residence. And as I understood him, it's been the last 3 months he's been looking. He should have started at least 1 January. You people were very generous to allow him to stay there till 1 September. On the 4th of September, I called Debbie and I asked her if that what the rule was, if I remember the date right. She said yes. She tried to put me in contact with Deputy Lutnow. He wasn't in. I left a message. I didn't get a response. On the 5th, I contacted the Sheriff's Department and asked them about it. And they responded, and they went to the home. They had a conversation with him. As far as I'm concerned, he's a very irresponsible person. If you look at their residence, the deck, they live on the second floor. On the deck, it looks like it's a disaster all the time. In fact, at one time, they were sighted, I believe they were sighted, because they had a great big tarp up there hanging over the porch for shade. If you do give them an extension, then I would recommend midnight, 20 September. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak with regard to this issue?
Hi, I'm Jackie Winslow, 338 Beaufort Street. Beaufort Street. I just want to make it known that my husband and I both agreed to this decision to have the ordinance be enforced.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to speak? Okay, we will take up the rules. Is there a motion with regard to this item? I
I'd like to make a motion that we deny Mr. Munyon's request for an extension on the forbearance that was issued last December. Is there a second? Trustee Rafter? Second discussion? I was the first person to agree to, I think we were talking about 6 months when we talked about this last December, and I was the first person to ask that we extend it through the summer. And I remember your case back then, and I really sympathized with you. You seemed like you had turned your life around, and I'm convinced you probably have turned your life around, and you're trying to do the best that you can, which is why we gave an extra 3 months to try to take you through the summer. And I thought it was more than generous. And I just don't, especially after all the conversations that we've had, hours of conversations about our residency ordinance in the village during the past 9 months, I just can't see that extending this again is going to be consistent with what we've done. We've long since said that we want to develop ordinances that make sense in the village and then enforce them or throw them out. And this is a case where I think we were fair and we made an agreement, and I personally need to stick with it. It's not that I don't sympathize with you. I really do, and I wish you the best, and I'm hoping that we might be able to help you in some capacity find some place to live, because I really don't like the idea of you being homeless, but I still can't extend this any further. Any further discussion? Trustee Gast?
No, I agree with everything the village president said. I mean, I think this came up in December of 2013, and we're, 10 months away from that. Shouldn't listen to the landlord, tell you to wait till June or July. And, but I do feel for you, but we, at the time that we revisited you on kind of a forbearance agreement, the board was pretty clear that we like the ordinance as it is. And we have to be uniform in how we enforce the ordinance and make it applicable to everybody. And we gave you a special exemption for 9 or 10 months because you had a unique circumstance in terms of how you approached the village and what you understood at the time that you moved into the residence that you did. But I think it's just time that we got to get back on the ordinance track. I mean, that was a good deal of forbearance in there. And the other thing is, here we sit on September, 16th, and, it didn't come back to us before the September 1st date arrived and went and passed. And it took Mr. Pinker, for example, getting a hold of the village itself, saying, well, isn't that date come and gone? I think it would have behooved you a little bit better if you wanted to make a request for a further extension to have addressed the board before the expiration on September 1st. So, but we just got to enforce our ordinances as they're written, because they're written for everybody. But we did give you a 9-10 month exemption to find a new place. I think that was adequate. I feel sorry for you. I wish you well, too, and I hope you can find some place. But we got to enforce our ordinances as they are, because the board said at the time we granted you the forbearance that we liked the ordinance itself, that we weren't interested in revisiting the ordinance. So for these 9 or 10 months, you're the only person in the village it didn't apply to, because we understood your circumstance, but that was 9 or 10 months ago. So I think we got to get back on track with the ordinance applicable to everyone, including you.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Item 10, action regarding the request for clarification of Village Ordinance 100.09D4 from Mr. Fuller.
So
Trevor, you want to start us out here?
Sure. Currently, the Economic Development Committee has six regular members and one village board member with one vacancy. It was asked at the Economic Development Committee if that was enough to have a full committee. The way it reads in the ordinance, it is not. I guess we're just looking for a little clarification as far as maybe how how the board interprets the ordinance.
So I read it as 8 members.
Right.
7 regular and 1 board member.
I read it.
Right, but 7. I guess one of the things that came up when we first organized the Economic Development Committee, I'm the board member that represents that committee. It was kind of not understood if I was a regular member or an ad hoc member, if I was a voting member. And then I remember it going that, yes, indeed, I was a voting member. And then the question arose years later, does that mean I'm part of the 7? Or in addition to?
You're part of the 8.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a committee member.
It says 7 regular members, and I think by regular members, I mean non-trustee members.
Non-public official.
Non-public official members.
Is that a normal number? Do we usually have 8? Like on?
No.
No.
Usually you have an odd number so that votes then don't end up tied, but I don't think there's anything that says you can't have any number that you want. Do you find the committee to be overwhelmingly large, or are you feeling you just want clarification, or do you have an opinion about it? Do you have an opinion about the size of the committee?
Not in particular. I think
new members was on our agenda, so we go, wait, aren't we full? No, maybe we're not. Well, maybe we are.
Do you have a hard time maintaining 8 members on that committee? I know there's been some recent turnover.
Short one right now.
Is that usually the case that you're short 1 or 2, or have you been up?
I believe we've been short now for a little bit.
Ted Zeman. He's kind of on off, waiting for us to fill that position. But then the question came up, wait, is we full?
The way I read it is 8 members. Does anyone read it inconsistent with that?
I read it as 8.
And that the trustee is a voting member and not considered one of the 7 regular members. If you think that you'd like to change that, because we constantly have a vacancy on the committee and you think 7 makes more sense, bring it back and we can discuss that. I don't think it makes too much difference, at least in my mind, whether it's 7 or 8. But the way that I read the current ordinance, it's 8. Further consensus? Yeah. Do we need action on that? Can we give you enough direction to move forward, Trevor?
Yeah.
I do need, since it is an action item on the agenda, I'll entertain a motion with regard to this item. Trustee Dart?
I'll make the motion that the board understands the committee to be made up of 7 regular members and 1 trustee.
Is there a second? Trustee Gass, second. Discussion?
Did that make the trustee an irregular member?
No.
That's not part of the motion.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. Is there a motion to adjourn? Trustee Raft or second? Trustee Gass. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? We're adjourned. Thank you very much, folks.